we're in a series. We're calling it Battle, okay? The whole idea of this series is that we want to battle for relationships that matter most in our lives. Too often, we fight with those people that are so important to us, and we really want to start fighting for those relationships with those people that are most important. Last week, we talked about marriage. It's important to fight for our marriages, and we talked about that last week. This week, we're talking about battling for friends, battling for your friends. Now, wouldn't you agree with me that having good friends is one of life's greatest blessings? We love people that love us. We like to be around people that like to be around us. We like to have something in common sometimes with people. It's a great blessing of life. And I was thinking about some of the friendships that you might know. And I've got some pictures here. Let's put one up there. So that's Hermione, right? And then there's Ron. And then there's Harry Potter, right? Okay. Ross, Rachel, Monica, Chandler, Phoebe Ann, Joey. All right. Some of you know them. How many of you have seen every episode of Friends? Raise your hand. Quite a few of you. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So now going back a little further, some of you can know this one. How many of you have seen every episode of those people? Yeah. Vivian Vance and Lucille Ball, right? Lucy and Ethel. That's who we call them. Yeah. So we know friends. We like to see the stories of friends, and we like for ourselves to have a story of our friends. We want that in our lives. I heard someone talk about friendship recently, and they were saying basically this: we'll be friends forever because that guy knows too much about me. And I'm thinking, you know what? I've got some friends like that. I've got friends. And if you go to Wichita Falls, Texas, and you look up Tom up there, I'm not going to tell you his last name. Some of you would do it. Runs an insurance agency up there. And you say, tell me stuff about Doug. His mind is immediately going to go back to that night when we were driving down Ford Road and that cow jumped out in front of us in that car. And his sister's old Capri hit that cow and totaled that car. And we walked a lengthy amount into town and we cleaned ourselves up. And we went back out there and there were 5 agencies of the government, Texas and other, and the Texas Cattlemen's Association. They were looking for bodies out in the field. They were looking for us. And he would tell you that story. And then he might tell you a couple others that I wouldn't want you to hear. Really, really wouldn't want you to hear. Yeah. Friendship, right? He knows too much. I won't tell everything on him. He won't tell everything on me. And we just kind of have this, you know, mutually assured destruction pact going on. That's kind of how it works in friendship sometimes. But the Bible says we need friends. Friends are important. Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9. The Bible says, 2 are better than 1 because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up, but pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. And we see this in the Gospels. We see this in the life of Jesus. I mean, Jesus, we find over in Acts chapter 1, has this group of about 120 that'll stick with you, pretty close friends. And then Jesus has this group of 12, right? Matthew 10, 2 through 4. We have this list of these apostles, these folks. And then Jesus has this group of 3. We have a kind of the quad squad. We have Jesus, Peter, James, and John. And they're together. But I want to tell you, Jesus, his experience can inform ours. Friendships will get tested. Think about those closest to Jesus. On the night of Jesus' betrayal, he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. If there's ever a time you needed your friends, now's the time. What happens? Jesus is praying. I mean, like blood and tears mixed together kind of praying. Remember what happens? The 3 are with him. They start dozing off, kind of like some of you do in a sermon. Yeah. And they start going to sleep, right? And Jesus has to wake them up, right? So it doesn't bother me when you sleep in church. Jesus had the same problem. And then one of the 12 is going to betray him. And then others are going to bail on him. And then one of that close three, Peter, is going to deny him. Blankety blank, I never knew the guy. Jesus experienced the difficulty of friendship. Here's what I find for many of us, though. Maybe when we were in high school, or maybe it was in college, in our young adulthood, we had these friends and we poured our lives into them and we nurtured those relationships. We invested in those relationships. But things happen. The responsibilities of becoming adult, adulting happens. And so you have to do this thing called work sometimes, and you have to get a job. And then maybe you have some family responsibilities. And all of a sudden, those relationships that used to be so important, that you used to pour life into and invest in, they become less and less close. And then you look up one day and it's like, who would I really call upon if I really needed something? That happens sometimes. And some of us have online hundreds or maybe even thousands of friends. But are we really that close to those hundreds or thousands on Facebook? Is that really what it means to have friendship? Well, the Bible offers us an example of friendship that gets tested and friendship that endures. And it's in the story in the Old Testament of two friends. It's found in 1 Samuel. They're David and Jonathan. And I want us to flip over in your Bibles. Turn over to 1 Samuel. We'll be there in just a little bit. Jonathan is the son of King Saul, which means he comes with privileges and opportunities, right? He's a prince, basically. And we see that being a prince has lots of perks that comes along with it. 1 Samuel 13, verse 22. Here's one of the perks of being a prince at that time, 1000 BC in Israel. 1 Samuel 13, 22. So on the day of the battle, none of the people of Israel had a sword or a spear except for Saul and Jonathan. You've heard of gun control? Well, this is sword control, spear control. I don't know why. I don't know what's going on. Maybe they were confiscated. Maybe I don't have any understanding of really why they didn't have any spears or swords. But the king, Saul, and the prince, Jonathan, each of them, they have a weapon. So growing up in the palace has perks. Now, you would think that perhaps Jonathan would be sort of a spoiled palace brat, but he's really not. He's a person of integrity and character, and he loves God, and he loves God's country, God's people, Israel. And most of the people are probably thinking, he will make a fine king someday, because Saul has plenty of warts. We can see those in his life. But Jonathan now, Jonathan. Now there, that could be a great king someday. Well, that's when David comes on the scene and the spotlight immediately shifts away from Jonathan to David. And there could have been this big, huge rift between them. Now, they likely met as teenagers, probably. And at first glance, they probably don't have a lot in common. I mean, David is the eighth son of a sheep herder and he's out in the pasture. And Jonathan is the first son of the king and he's in the palace. And so you got the pasture and the palace, those two distinct differences. And they come together and they're fast friends. Their lives initially intersect because David is a musician. David plays the harp and he's evidently pretty good at it. The word's out about David. I don't know if he played cover tunes somewhere for whatever was going on in 1000 BC. A harp is kind of a first cousin to a guitar today. So my way of thinking, and to contemporize this, he's playing John Mayer cover tunes, maybe. That dude can play guitar. John Mayer, Cheryl and I saw him. We've seen Brad Paisley, your country western type. Brad Paisley can play guitar. Not as good as Cheryl's cousin, who's the lead guitarist for Lady A. But Brad Paisley's pretty good. Our Joe Walsh plays guitar. Yeah, really, really good. Still. And they're coming on the 14th of May to Houston. I don't know. He's popular. People, the word gets out. And so Saul likes his music. And Saul, you know, being king is a stressful job. Saul gets stressed out. He says, hey, bring David in. When he plays, guess what? Man, I can chill. You have that kind of music that you just really like. Some of you like elevator music. Slow. Some of you are classical music people. I'm not that sophisticated myself. Some of you like country western, you know. I sort of get it, but I sort of don't. That'd make a good country western title. Some of you are a little more rocking like me, a little classic rock. But for whatever reason, the music of David just soothes the soul of King Saul. So they bring him in. That's a pretty good gig if you're David to get the palace, right? Everybody wants that gig in Israel. And so David's just this hired musician. But he's kind of known in that area, around the palace. But in 1 Samuel 17, something really big happens. David trades in his harp for a sling. And there's this story. You remember the Valley of Elah? Some of us will be there in about 3 weeks or four. And David puts down this giant, and his name was Goliath. Yeah, big guy, Philistine, evil dude. David puts him down, and all of a sudden, David is a celebrity, not just because of his music, although that was good. David puts him down, and the really, really important thing to hear is that David is now really popular in Israel. And so you have Jonathan the prince and his good buddy David, the guy that plays music for his dad, and now everybody's talking about David instead of Jonathan. All of a sudden, they start writing songs about David. Now, I studied a little bit of Hebrew, and the psalm basically, I'm going to kind of perform one for you. It's right in the Bible. Saul has killed his thousands. David has killed his tens of thousands. You got to know Hebrew to do that. But that's basically what they're singing. All the ladies out there are singing about Saul killing his thousands and David killing his tens of thousands. Now, if you're the king, how does that make you feel? You're like, I don't know about that. And so it's not Jonathan that gets jealous. It's Saul that gets really jealous. And so David is trending. He's in the spotlight. He's elevated up here. He's really, really popular. And their friendship still goes on. 1 Samuel 18, look at verse 1. After David had finished talking with Saul, he met Jonathan, the king's son, and there was an immediate bond between them, for Jonathan loved David. From that day on, Saul kept David with him and wouldn't let him return home. And that eventually is going to be a problem. Now, verse 3. And Jonathan made a solemn pact with David. They blood brothers, kind of like. Solemn pact with David because he loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan sealed the pact by taking off his robe and giving it to David together with his tunic, sword, bow, and belt. And you don't have to think nudity here. That's not the deal. It's a special king's garment that's going on here. That sometimes people get mixed up on that. But it's like, hey, you know what? It's like you're the king now. That's how Jonathan treats David from the get-go. And he gives him his tunic, his sword, his bow, and his belt. Now, how many swords are there in the kingdom? Two. And Jonathan gives one up to David. That's a big, big deal. And maybe they have this immediate connection because they're both warriors. You know, we know David from taking down Goliath, but you might not know about Jonathan. Jonathan is a warrior, too. You have to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 14. Jonathan has this armor bearer, think kind of like a caddy on a golf course. But instead of saying, hey, give me a 7-iron, he says, hey, give me my sword. And so he has this armor bearer, and they know outside of town there are 20 Philistines out there. Jonathan looks at his armor bearer, his sword caddy, and he says, hey, I think we can take these guys. Are you with me? Are you with me? And the armor bearer says, I'm with you heart and soul. I'm in. I'm all in with you on this. And so they take out 20 Philistines, not just one big guy, but 20 Philistines, Jonathan and his armor bearer. And so he's kind of just as courageous as David, if you will, but you don't really know that story near as well as you know David and Goliath, right? And so I'm just wondering about these two and their friendship. I'm guessing that David and Jonathan are both thinking something like this. You know, I can roll with a guy like that. I like hanging out with a guy like that. He's smart. He's talented. He's gifted. He's courageous. He's brave. He's popular. I want to be with a guy like that. And so that leads to a principle about friendship that I want you to see today. And that is simply that true friends bring out the best in each other. True friends bring out the best in each other. They push each other rather than settle for some kind of mutual mediocrity. That's not what's going on here. So choose friends who make you feel better about yourself, or who hold. Don't choose friends that hold you back. Find somebody you admire. Find somebody that's as gifted or more gifted than you are. Find somebody that's as close to the Lord or closer to the Lord than you are. Be friends with them. You can learn from people like them. Find somebody you can respect and say, you know what? I'm going to foster a friendship with that person because I know they'll push me to be a better person. Bring out the best in them. Let them bring out the best in you. If you're looking for a friend, keep that principle in mind. And, you know, I think it was my mom first told me this when I was just a kid. Hey, show me your friends and I'll show you your future, Doug. Who are you hanging with? And that'll tell me how you're going to become. She had another saying, birds of a feather flock together. And the whole thing meant, hey, we're going to be around people like us. Are they going to improve us? Or are they going to drag us down? Really important when choosing friends. Pick your friends wisely. That's just good advice. And I already mentioned, you know, make sure you have real friends and not just virtual friends. Have you ever been in a restaurant and all these people around and their faces are all aglow and it's not the Shekinah glory of God, it's their devices. Yeah. And I'm not against technology. I use it. I'm all in. But I'm thinking, you know what? Sometimes we need to put those things down and have interactions with real people. Just do that. Friends are important. Scientific studies bear this out. A big study at Harvard of men across their lives from 20 to 80 found that the single best predictor of your health as a man and your happiness at age 80 is not your wealth or your professional success. It's the relationships you had at 50. BYU and the University of North Carolina, based on data from about 300,000 people in developed countries around the world, found that individuals with a large web of social ties have a 50% greater likelihood of surviving a heart attack or a stroke as compared with people with a limited social circle. It's good for your health, friendship. Another study, some of the same folks, researchers, found that among solitary individuals age 60, so solitary people age 60, the probability of death is 30% higher than among those with an extensive social network. It's good for your health. Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh found a connection between social ties and the body's immune system. A flu vaccine administered to thousands of students was far less effective among those who reported feelings of loneliness. And here's the conclusion. In other words, they say, the students who reported a feeling of loneliness had a far lower immunity to the virus. The stronger the sense of loneliness, the less effect the vaccine had. It's good for your health. Good for your health. All right. So it's not just science. It's a spiritual issue, though. And that's what I'm really interested. You see, I kind of think it's kind of like watching the National Geographic Channel. And they go to Africa and they have some predator animal. Maybe it's a big cat. And he's chasing this herd. And they're the wildebeests, right? The poor wildebeests are always the stars of National Geographic movies. And the job of the cat is to isolate somebody from the herd, right? So they go after the weakest, the oldest, the slowest, the one that has a limp or something like that. And they're trying to isolate that one. And that one's going down. And the rest of them that hang with the herd, they're going to go forward. You see, the enemy knows if he can isolate us, it breaks us out of the connection we need to be God's people. I want you to think about it from creation. Genesis chapter 1, God creates human beings in God's image. What's the image of God? Well, it's at least Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God is in community. God creates people to be in community. And so part of the reflection of the nature of God that we need to have is that relationship factor. Just as God is in community, we're created to be in community. And I know that's different for everybody, and some people are extroverted, and some people are introverted, and some people are, I get it. And some people are easily to make friends, and other people are a little more awkward and harder for them to make friends for whatever reasons, right? I get all that, but people need people. People need people. Well, as soon as David and Jonathan become buddies, their friendship is going to have a test. Look at verse 5 of chapter 18, 1 Samuel. Whatever Saul asked David to do, David did it successfully. David is successful. So he's going to get promoted. So Saul made him a commander over the men of war, an appointment that was welcomed by the people and Saul's officers alike. So you have David and you have Jonathan, similar in age, similar in gifting. David's an outsider. Jonathan's an insider. He's in line to become the next king, but David's getting all the attention. He's being promoted right over Jonathan, if you will. And that kind of leads to another principle, and that is that true friends root for each other. True friends root for each other. They celebrate each other's victory. They're not always comparing and competing. The comparison and the competition game, that goes nowhere fast. Do you have a friend that's really, really good at something? You have one of those friends, you have one of those maybe in high school or college. Everything they did was just top of the chart. I got a call about 3 weeks ago. It was my buddy Kent from high school. The last time we spent any significant amount of time, we were both giving speeches at our high school graduation. And Kent was thinking about going into ministry, and he went off to a school in Minnesota, and Kent decided there, no, that wasn't his deal. And now he sells commercial real estate in Atlanta and has one of the largest commercial real estate operations in the Southeast. He sells multiple shopping malls and big shopping centers every year, and he's the president and CEO of that company. He does a lot of other good things in the kingdom around the world. But that's Kent. And Kent is a smart, smart guy. I love being around him. He's really intelligent and he's just smart. Kent was an all-state pianist. He was the Baptist preacher's kid. I was the Church of Christ preacher's kid. I didn't get the piano gene. Kent could play quarterback. They stuck me at cornerback. Yeah. Kent was a really good basketball player. All right. I was usually the sixth man. I played a lot more than a lot of folks, but never really could crack the starting lineup very well in that, you know. I could jump okay and I was pretty quick, but getting that ball in that round thing was not my gift. I went into some engineering stuff, and then later went into ministry. And Kent and I are get together. We're at Spring Creek Barbecue, the Lord's place, and we're talking and we're catching up. And we took a long lunch. Elders, I hate to admit how long I spent at lunch that day with Kent, probably 2 hours. And we just talked and we caught up and about what's going on in life. And you know, we had this friendly rivalry when we were in high school together. And Kent said, Doug, you know, you and I've always kind of competed with you in things, you know. It was the academic stuff. It was Kent and Doug. Should have been Doug and Kent, but. And when we sort of compared ourselves to each other. And now at 50-something years old, we're sitting here eating barbecue, and we're talking about family, and we're talking about faith, and we're talking about relationships and what really matters in life. And it was such a gratifying experience, 2 hours that enriched my life. And I want you to have those kind of relationships with people. And the comparison game and the competing game, that doesn't help so much. Doesn't help so much. Well, true friends really do root for each other. Did I read 1 Samuel 19, 1 through 4? Well, I want to read it now, okay? Saul now urged his servants and his son Jonathan to assassinate David. Okay, something's changing here, right? Saul urged his servants and his son Jonathan to assassinate David. One minute he gets a promotion, the next minute he's on a hit list. But Jonathan, because of his strong affection for David, told him what his father was planning. Tomorrow morning, he warned him, you must find a hiding place out in the fields. I'll ask my father to go out there with me, and I'll talk to him about you. Then I'll tell you everything I can find out. The next morning, Jonathan spoke with his father about David, saying many good things about him. The king must not sin against his servant David, Jonathan said. He's never done anything to harm you. He has always helped you in any way he could. And so the principle here that I think you need to see is that true friends have each other's backs. That's what's going on here. True friends have each other's backs, even when it requires something from us, sacrifice. And I can imagine how easy it would have been for Jonathan, if he was in the comparison and the compete game, just to pull back and say, I'm just going to set this one out. I'm going to stay on the sidelines of this one. Now, what complicates the matter in this whole deal is that David's not really sure Jonathan has his back. Look at chapter 20 now, verse 1. David now fled from Naoth and Ramah and found Jonathan. What have I done? He exclaimed. What is my crime? How have I offended your father that he's so determined to kill me? That's not true, Jonathan protested. So you got this argument going on, this protest going on. You're not going to die. He always tells me everything he's going to do, even the little things. I know my father wouldn't hide something like this from me. It just isn't so. So you have David and Jonathan in this argument. David says, man, your dad's out to get me. He's going to do me in. And Jonathan says, no, you're misreading this. It's not how it's going to go down. You see, their friendship's strong enough that they can be honest with each other. And true friends, here's another principle. True friends tell you what you need to know even when it's hard to hear. True friends tell you what you need to know even when it's a difficult truth to hear. There's a proverb that I've always wondered about. It's Proverbs chapter 27, verse 6. And basically it says, wounds from a friend can be trusted. And in the context, I think what it's saying there is, wounds from a friend can be trusted. It's hard truths that hurt a little bit and sting a little bit, but if they're your friend, if they've got your back, then it's okay. You can learn from it. They can instruct you. Good friends will actually care enough to say difficult things. Be a good friend. A good friend's care enough to say difficult things like, hey, bud, I saw you sort of flirting with that person. And you're a married guy, and you don't need to be doing that. I'm not saying you've done anything, but I am saying be careful. And that's hard to say, and that's also hard to hear, perhaps. But a good friend will do or say something like that. A good friend will look you in the eye and say, hey, I've been watching, I've been observing, and you just seem bitter. You seem cynical right now. What's going on? How can I help you? How can I pray for you? And it hurts to hear something like that. But that's a hurt that's coming in love. True friends do that sort of thing. So David understands what's going on, and he realized Jonathan just doesn't get it. So basically Saul is using their friendship to divide them up between them. Now look at verses 3 and 4 of 1 Samuel 20. David took an oath before Jonathan and said, your father knows perfectly well about our friendship. So he has said to himself, I won't tell Jonathan. Why should I hurt him? But I swear to you that I am only a step away from death. I swear it by the Lord and by your own soul. Tell me what I can do to help you, Jonathan exclaimed. Tell me what I can do. So David develops this strategy. He says, hey, your dad's invited me. There's going to be a new moon festival party, and I think he's going to try to take me out at the party. So remember that place we used to meet up when we were younger and kind of play out there in that field? I'll meet you out there. Tell your dad I'm going to take a vacation. I'm going to go visit family in Bethlehem or something like that. And if your dad flies off the handle because I didn't show up at the party, then we'll know. He's out to get me. Something's up. But if he's cool with it, says, oh, good, I'm glad David had a chance to go on a vacation, then we'll know I'm safe and I can come back. And so Jonathan says, hey, sounds like a good plan. I like the strategy. Down in verse 16 of 1 Samuel 20. So Jonathan made a solemn pact with David, saying, may the Lord destroy all your enemies. And Jonathan made David reaffirm his vow of friendship again. For Jonathan loved David as he loved himself. Well, Sure enough, at this party, Saul loses it completely, and he gets really mad, and he even figures out that Jonathan is in on this plot, you know, to foil his plot, and he says some horrible things to his son Jonathan. He even throws a spear, and there are not many of them in the kingdom, right? He throws a spear at Jonathan. Not a happy guy. Jonathan now knows David isn't safe, and so he's going to encourage David to flee. And so we find one of the final interactions in 1 Samuel 20, down in verse 41. Both of them were in tears as they embraced each other and said goodbye, especially David. I think David knows he's losing a friend this day. Like, there's nobody that would be as loyal to me as Jonathan. Verse 42, at last Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we have sworn loyalty to each other in the Lord's name. The Lord is the witness of a bond between us and our children forever." Then David left, and Jonathan returned to the town. And so now David becomes a fugitive. He's hiding out caves. He's staying under the radar of Saul. But one day he wakes up, and he gets a very sad message, and that message is simply this: his good friend Jonathan dies in a battle. And his dad, Saul, the king, also dies. And so eventually David ends up becoming the king, just as Jonathan said he would. Now, you need to understand something about ancient dynasties. When you shift from one dynasty to the other, from one king's family to another king's family, everybody knows what's supposed to happen. The new king is supposed to wipe out all the family of the old king. You just do them in. You eliminate competition. You don't want somebody that's going to challenge the throne again. You don't want somebody out there rebel-rousing and saying, "Hey, you know, it was better when my dad or my grandpa was king or my uncle." You don't want that going on. But David doesn't do that. Instead, David basically sends out a private eye, an investigator, says, hey, see if there's anybody left. Does Jonathan have any family? Does Jonathan have any children out there? Is there any family? Because of the pact that they made, the bond that they had. And the investigator finds one, and he comes back and says, there's one. There's one, and his name is Mephibosheth, and he's disabled. He's disabled. And instead of ignoring him or sending somebody to take him out, instead of marginalizing him, David reaches out in compassion, and he brings this descendant of Jonathan and Saul to the palace, and he treats him like one of his own. He pulls him up to the table. I can just imagine this wonderful feast of a meal prepared for the king and his entourage and his family, and they're sitting down, and the dinner bell's already rung, and they're all coming to eat, and then you have the last guy to come, and he's on a crutch, and he sits down at the table, the guy that's different and disabled. And the king treats him like one of his own. That's what's going on in this story. That leads me to a final principle, and that is that true friends make sacrifices for each other. True friends really make sacrifices for each other. And that's exactly what Jesus has done for you and for me. You know, there are a number of names for Jesus in the New Testament, and I like all those names. All those "I am" statements in the Gospel of John. But there's one name that I really want to call your attention to today. One thing Jesus was called, and Jesus was called a friend of sinners. Jesus is not called a friend of everybody that had it all down and perfect. Jesus is not called a friend of the religious types. You don't read that in the Bible. Jesus is not called a friend of people that don't have any mess in their lives. Jesus is called a friend of sinners. We don't have all the answers, folks, and we're all messed up in our own ways. And yet Jesus is willing to say, "I'll be your friend. I'll be your friend." In fact, Jesus is everything we've talked about today. He's willing to bring out the best in each of us. And he's rooting for us, even when times are tough. Jesus has our back in a sense. And you know, sometimes the words of Jesus are what we need to hear, even if they hurt. And he's willing to make a sacrifice for us. Jesus would say this in John chapter 15, verse 13. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Well, who's he talking about here? Well, the next verse is clear. You are my friends if you do what I command. And so I leave you with this today. No matter your background, no matter your past, no matter the mess you've made, you can have a friend in Jesus, the greatest friend, the one who willingly on the cross lays down his life. And then he calls us to do the same for our friends. He calls us to love each other. Right now, I'd ask you to stand, and we're going to sing about what it really means to love each other.